Welcome to What's Next, a podcast produced by Parcion Private Wealth. My name is Terry Cook, your host and founder of Parcion Private Wealth. At Parcion, we help entrepreneurs, business owners, and their families make the most of the opportunities their hard work affords them. And when appropriate, optimize wealth events to fuel the future. A wealth event can take many forms. Most often, we work with business owners to plan for the sale of their business. Our work, though, spans far beyond helping on that wealth event. In short, we help our clients plan for what's next. That includes helping to provide financial clarity and confidence for their future. Our approach for each client is to form a customized team of professionals, both within and outside our firm, who bring expertise in areas specific to the business owner's individual situation. One of the great benefits of my work at Parcion is my ability to work with and to serve truly remarkable entrepreneurs and business people. I created this podcast with the goal of connecting experts with other experts in wealth management and other areas that support entrepreneurs and their families. With that, I'm excited for today's guest, Bruce Feiler. Bruce has had a remarkable career. He's the author of 7 New York Times bestsellers, including his most recent Life is in the Transitions, Mastering Change at Any Age, where he examines how people deal with and manage major life changes, built on interviews with people in every state in the country. Bruce is also the presenter of 2 primetime series on PBS and the inspiration of Council of Dads on NBC. You might have seen Bruce presenting one of his 3 TED Talks that have been viewed more than 4 million times or read his work in the New York Times, among other publications. Now, we recently had the great pleasure of inviting Bruce to make a presentation to a group of our clients. Some of you might have heard that at our inaugural signature event this past fall. And we were all so inspired and enthused by Bruce, I asked him to join us today. So with all of that, thank you, Bruce, for joining.
Thank you, Terry, for inviting me. I feel honored and very welcome to be part of the Parcion family, and I admire what you're doing, and I especially admire your kind of willingness to go into the kind of sticky messiness of life and help people there. That you're not just, the way I think about this is, you're not just a numbers person, you're also a words person. You're dealing with the emotion behind all of these things, and I just admire that, and I'm happy to be in this conversation.
Well, thank you, and yes, we love to dig into the complexities, and that's what you're here to help us with. And as you know, we've discussed that many of our clients have or will experience something that we call a wealth event. It's most typically selling their business that they may have built up over decades and decades and maybe generations. Your book, Life in the Transitions, Mastering Change at Any Age, you call sale of a business as an example of a life quake, as you term it. Can you talk to us about what a life quake is and what folks should know about that, or what can be some of the effects of that?
Well, I got interested in this area, Terry, as you know, because I went through a life quake. Actually, what I did was I went through, kind of a, what I call a pileup, multiple events. I had in my life a sort of straight, linear, upward trajectory, the life that we all fantasize about. Like, I figured out what I wanted to do early, and then I had some success, and I got married and had children. But then in my 40s, I had a back-to-back set of disruptive life events. First, I got cancer. You mentioned the Council of Dads, which came out of that when my children were quite young. Then I got into financial trouble during the Great Recession. And then my father, who built multi-generation family business that I am a part of, got Parkinson's, got very depressed, and tried to take his own life 6 times in 12 weeks. And I am a word person. Like, I like telling stories, and I didn't know how to tell this story and didn't want to. And so I set off on this journey that you alluded to, collecting what became hundreds of life stories of Americans of all ages, all walks of life, all 50 states. And then I spent a year analyzing with 12 people what has become 400 of these life stories. And I would say that I learned 3 things. Number one, this linear life that those of us you and I are of the same generation, broadly speaking, the idea that life proceeds through a very standard set of phases and stages, and we have a midlife crisis. This is all bunk. Like, the linear life is dead. And it's been replaced by what I call the nonlinear life. And that has many more disruptive events. My data show that we go through one disruptive event every 12 to 18 months. I mean, that's more often than most people see a dentist. And some of these we get through with relative ease because they're small. It's a fender bender, right? We twist an ankle and we have to be on crutches for 6 weeks, right? Or we have COVID or whatever it might be. But one in 10 of these becomes what I call a life quake, which is a massive burst of change that requires rethinking and reorienting all parts of our lives. And my data show that we go through 3 to 5 of these in the course of a lifetime. Their average length is 5 years. So 3 to 5, 4, 5, 6 years. That's 25 years, Terry. That's half of our adult lives we are in this state of transition. And so the final kind of lesson that I learned is that if we view transitions as periods that we have to grit and grind and kind of grovel our way through, we're missing half of our lives, that transitions are a skill that we can and must master. So kind of my message to people going through one of these events is you're not alone. And there actually are things you can do to handle this period more wisely and more effectively.
Well, and we can talk, and you mentioned a lot of different types of transitions, life quakes. You know, the sale of a business is just one, but everybody deals with a death of a family member or simply just a change in career. What are, talk about instead of grinding through it, being able to maybe prepare for it. And what are some tools that people can use, knowing that we're all going to experience this? What are some tools and best practices that you found in researching the book?
So I would say the first thing I would say is that people tend to be in one of two camps, right? When they go through a life quake, right? So the way to think about this is that the life quake is the shock. It's the change. It puts us on our heels. The life transition is what puts us on our toes and allows us to move forward and get through it, okay? It's when we stop playing defense and we start playing offense, so to speak, right? People tend to do one of two things when they get into a life quake. Either they make a 212-item to-do list and say, I'm going to get through it in the weekend and be the best ever and get a blue ribbon because I'm used to being, you know, organized and the best. Or they lie under the covers, you know, with a pillow and a cat and say, I'm never going to get through it and woe is me. And neither really is going to work. And so the first thing I would say is to understand when you look at enough of these, as I have done, that transitions have a kind of structure to them. There are 3 phases. I call them the long goodbye, when you sort of absorb the emotional impact and you mourn the past and say, I'm not going to go back. Then there's this messy middle where you shed certain habits and then you begin to experiment with new habits. And in fact, transitions can be quite creative periods. And then there's the new beginning where you unveil your new self. So the first thing to do is to think you are not alone. There is wisdom about this. You know, my wife likes to joke that I have hard knowledge about soft things. And so these are moments that lots of other people have gone through, and there actually are things that you can do to manage it. Even when you're talking about selling a business, even, for example, one of the things about the long goodbye is that it's a very emotional period when you do something like this, right? You know, kind of my benchmark, you know, dealing with family wealth and families in general, right, is that every conversation about money is a conversation about values. Even a conversation that's not being had, because that's passing on the value that talking about money is complicated and scary and we shouldn't do it. And that's sort of stigmatizing it even more. So even a simple question to ask yourself if you are in a life quake, and let's just talk about the one that, you know, that your clients may be dealing with, and a wealth, what you call a wealth event, which I love that term. What is the biggest emotion that you are struggling with? What is the biggest emotion, right? What are you scared of, okay? The top 3 answers are fear. How am I going to get through this, right? How am I going to deal with my children? How am I going to pass on money without screwing up my family, right? That's a fear issue, okay? Then the next is sadness. I kind of like my old life. Like, I had to get up every morning. I went to work. I had a structure. Like, I knew who I was. Now I have all this time, and I'm like sad and confused by that. And the third is interesting because it's shame. You know, what do people feel ashamed about? They have to ask for help. So even calling someone like you and admitting, I built a business, like I'm used to being in charge, I'm used to having confidence and agency. Now I have to turn to this stranger and say, I'm now in a situation where I don't know what to do. And that actually evinces shame in a lot of people. So ask yourself, what is the biggest emotion? And then tell somebody else how you're feeling. Just that act of sharing it can be very effective.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do a presentation for groups of business owners, the 4 P's of pre-liquidity event planning. There's the building your professional team, pre-sale planning, post-sale, you know, implementation, kind of the new order, so to speak. And then there's the psychological effects of selling a business, you know, the redefining your purpose, the loss of identity, the loss of community. How would you kind of characterize this? And I feel like it's very underappreciated going into a business sale and really causes some unhappiness or even regret coming out the other side.
Well, let me say a couple things. The first thing I want to say is, why do I like the term lifequake? I like the term lifequake because it is value neutral. The way most people have talked about major life, you know, kind of turning points over the years is they use words like crisis, right? Or trauma or challenge or catastrophe. Well, I am the parent of identical twin girls. When my wife became pregnant and when we had newborn twins, it was a lifequake. It was joyful, but also everything else around it had to be redefined. So there is, people might think, wait a minute, I sold a business, right? You know, I have more money than I grew up with. Like, this shouldn't be a problem. Well, it doesn't matter. Even a positive lifequake, even a voluntary lifequake is still a lifequake. So just accepting the fact that, again, I keep saying this because it's such a kind of primary message of mine, is you're not alone, okay? And suffering in silence is never going to work. It's never a good strategy on anything. A problem shared is a problem halved, is a line I talk about. There's a lot of research about this of like, don't try to go through this alone. And this is what you know, because you and I've become friendly over the last 6 months, I understand. It's like, even you, when you started this business, right, which was a positive lifequake for you, you went through things that you may not have understood. Like, you thought you were just going to be providing financial services, and you realized, guess what? I've got to provide psychological services, right? And so you had to get outside your comfort zone. And so that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is that a lifequake is fundamentally a meaning-making exercise, okay? And how do we make meaning? But we have to, it's fundamentally an act of storytelling. Animals can be happy, because happiness, we have some this obsession with happiness. Happiness is like how I feel right now. Like, animals can be happy, but animals can't make meaning, because meaning is stitching together past, present, and future into a coherent story. So the first thing that I would encourage people to do is to understand that what you're doing in a lifequake, or in this case, a wealth event, is adding a new chapter to your life story. And the nature of a wealth event is, it's not an isolated solo event. You're going through it with your family. It's also a multi-generational event, because it taps into probably your own childhood and the values about money and wealth that you grew up with. And it's now tapping into the values about money that you're going to pass on to your children and to your grandchildren. So basically, a lifequake is a meaning vacuum where all the sources of meaning, there's three sources of meaning. I call them the ABCs of meaning. Agency, what you do, make, or create. B, belonging, that's your relationships, your loved ones. And C, your cause. Okay? A purpose, something higher than yourself. And what happens in a lifequake, we all have all three of these. And what happens in a lifequake is that we shape shift, we readjust them. So maybe you've been all agency, building this business, like, you know, maximizing profit and return. And maybe you've been downplaying your family, or maybe you haven't been giving back to your community in a way. And what happens in a lifequake is that we adjust. So maybe your agency is less, but you get to spend more time with your family. Or maybe what you need is a way to get back to the community in some way. So it's like we have, you know, whatever, pebbles in three scales, and we readjust them. And that's a very natural thing, and it's a very healthy thing. So kind of a simple piece of advice is, if you are selling a business, maybe then focus on the B and the C of the ABCs of meaning. And if you're a family member, and you've been mostly passive as your partner or your parent builds it, you may have to step up and say, okay, I want to have more agency in this process of deciding how we're going to build a new life. So think about adjusting your ABCs as a simple but incredibly valuable thing you can do to begin to take some, I don't know, back to lean in, like go back on your toes to take some role in making this time better.
That's interesting. I've been talking to a lot of folks about, you know, entrepreneurs, as I've found, entrepreneurs don't like the term retirement. They want to, whether it's the next phase, a lot of them talk about starting another company, whether they do or not, but they don't necessarily like the term retirement, in my experience. And from an observation, you know, you see some people selling their business or quote unquote retiring and going and playing golf every day and aspiring to that. These are folks at the top of their game, incredible amounts of business acumen, experience, and they're really good at their job. And then they go do something that they're not very good at every day. Why they're not happy. I like to do what I'm good at. And I like to play golf, but is it beating myself up if I do that every day? So can you speak to that in the context of the ABCs and how that might relate?
So now we're going to venture a little bit further afield here, right? Because as you said, I spent years collecting and analyzing stories about life changes and wrote a book called Life is in the Transitions that was published in 2020. I've spent the last 3 years, as you know, collecting and analyzing work stories for a new book that I am publishing in the spring of 2023. And that book is called The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a Post-Career World. And it is exactly about this topic, Terry, because what it talks about is that the idea, there's like three lies about work, that there's a career, that there's a straight, you lock into a passion early and you're going to follow that. Well, that doesn't happen anymore because our passions change and our lives evolve and we have much more fluidity. My data on work quakes actually shows that we have one every 2.85 years, which leads to the second, there is no set path. You can get on the path, you can get off the path. This is fantastic, particularly like for women who might have gotten off the path to raise children and want to get back on. It used to be you couldn't get back on. Well, guess what? Now you can. And there is no job. And this is the point I want to say. We all have multiple jobs, okay? There's main jobs, there's side jobs. There's this new kind of job that I call a hope job, which is, you know, like writing a screenplay that you hope becomes a movie or selling muffins at the farmer's market that you hope becomes a business. There's care jobs of caring for family, and there's what I call ghost jobs, which are things that haunt us, like discrimination or worries about money that feel like a burden that take up a lot of time. And so the way I think to think about this is that you're not going to do one thing after a work quake of the kind that we're talking about, selling a business. Maybe you want to play golf in the morning, but what are you going to do in the afternoon, right? And the way to think about that is, I call it work 360. This unified collection of multiple jobs is that we take different meaning from different parts of them. So maybe you're not going to take meaning from the fact that you were running a business for 18 hours a day for 18 years, and you want to spend more time joy and connecting, whether it's traveling or glass blowing or being in a book group or whatever it is, but you can also do something on the side, or maybe you can mentor, or maybe you can teach, right? Or maybe you can advise the next generation on a business that they're starting. So the way to think about it is not, you're not doing only one thing from 9 to 5 and then having a martini, having dinner, and then watching TV. It's a collection of things that we do, and that's how we make meaning through the collective way that we spend our time. But it all comes down to me. The reason my book is called The Search is that fewer people are searching merely for work anymore. More and more people are searching for work with meaning. So how we spend our time is a primary way we make meaning. So be open and feel blessed that you can now cobble together a number of different ways of spending your time and a number of different ways that bring you meaning.
And you mentioned belonging, and I would term that as, you know, the need for community as well. I assume that's what you mean there. And it's also from that collection of different activities that you can find or refine and build a community.
That's exactly right. The simplest way to think about it is there's this term that I love, actually, which was invented by a psychologist who taught at Harvard and now teaches at Cambridge over in the UK. He terms them personal projects. Okay. A personal project can be something as small as, you know, I want to cover up that hole in the backyard before someone trips in it, or I want to learn to speak Spanish, or I want to start a new company. It's a personal project. So the simplest way to think about it is in a time of transition, start a new personal project in each of the ABCs of meaning. So start something that you do for yourself. Something that you always wanted to do. I want to read a biography of every president, okay? You know, I want to learn to macrame, okay? I want to finally build that bookshelf in the basement. A personal project for yourself. Then do a personal project that will connect you to somebody else. I want to build a bookshelf, you know, in my daughter-in-law's office, okay? I want to take a trip. I spent yesterday, having this conversation after a national holiday. I have a lot on my plate, but I have a daughter who's just developed an interest in art. And I'm like, you know what? We're going to go to every museum in New York City in the next 6 months. So we went to a museum yesterday. Like, that's a personal project. That's a belonging act because we're connected and we have a little game that we're going to play. And then the third would be to do a personal project in a cause, giving back, That's volunteering. You know, it could be a religious organization, could be a community organization, could be the Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, right? It's something that you do for, you could be a docent in a museum. You get the idea. So do a personal project in each of the ABCs of meaning will balance out that sense of I'm doing for others, doing for myself, and then also also making the world a better place.
So let's transition a little bit, and you started to talk about doing something with your daughter. Let's transition on how these lifequakes can affect those around us, and particularly, you know, a retirement or a selling a business and transitioning. And let's start with our spouse. You know, you've heard a lot of the concerns, and even some data shows about how divorces can pick up after a lifequake such as this. What, in your studies, what are some best practices around making sure that you don't upset some of these relationships?
Well, let's look at some of the options. We can dictate from on high. Here's how this is going to work. Okay. We can keep our anxieties to ourselves. Okay. You know, we can run off and say, okay, well, I've sold this business now. I want to walk the Appalachian Trail. I'll see you in 3 months. How are any of those going to work? They're not going to work. So I think, again, the simplest thing is also the most profound thing. And in this case, this is not an isolated event. And even, in fact, it might be even worse if the spouse in this case had been watching you sell a business, which by definition is maybe not something that the spouse was most involved in and maybe led to an 18 to 24 month buildup. It's quite possible that a lot of tensions were underneath the surface, that as soon as the event happens that you think is going to be celebratory, all of these built up, you know, conflicts are going to come out. We just went through this in my family, where my identical twin daughters have been going through what I call the college application death march. And because of the intensity of it, you know, and the competitiveness, by definition, like, those applications had to be in, those choices had to be made, right, over the last 2 years. And as soon as it happened, and in our case, we had a fortunate outcome, and everyone was like, oh my God, you're going to be dancing champagne and, you know, taking vacations. In fact, we are going to take a nice family vacation to celebrate. But there were a lot of things that got pushed down. So don't be surprised if the geyser bursts. When, really? Now you're bugging me about that leak in the basement? I just sold a business that's going to create intergenerational wealth, and you're bugging me about this? Like, well, yeah, honey, because if I did it 4 months ago, you would have said, I'm busy selling this business and I can't bother. So the first answer is to realize it's not an isolated event and have a conversation about it. Okay, not only what emotion am I struggling with, but Terry, you're my partner or my, you know, you're my heir or whatever it might be. What's the biggest emotion that you're struggling with? And what can we do? So just understanding the basic emotions, okay? Because here's the thing about a business seller. I have found, back to my three phases, right? The long goodbye, the messy middle, the new beginning. I have found that everybody's good at one phase and they're bad at another. Okay, I call them your transition superpower and your transition
kryptonite.
Kryptonite, thank you. My kryptonite was remembering that word. So let's just say your business, but it might be, I talked to a business guy who was a consultant, and he was hired to run a very high-end glass company in Vermont. And he moved across the country and he went to work at this high-end glass company a month after the Great Recession. Sales cratered by a third in the first month, and a year later, he was out of a job. He's like, but I was a consultant. I was good at the messy middle. Like, I was good at making lists and calling contacts and coming up with something new to do. And he moved his family to Africa so he could do a cause-oriented thing for a few years. They adopted a new child and they moved back home. He was great at the messy middle, but usually that means you kind of suck at the long goodbye. So if you are somebody who's good at making lists and being practical and being efficient and getting things done, that probably means you're overlooking the emotional part of it, the long goodbye, where you realize that you have these internal struggles. So I think it might be an interesting thing with your partner, like, what's your instinct? Some people, I'm going to turn the page. I'm never going to talk about that. I mean, people have cancer. Like, and my mother was like this. She had cancer twice. It's like she had the surgery, she took the medicine, and never wants to talk about it again, right? I just have a nephew who went through a similar thing. I'm the kind of person who likes going into the darkness and the muck and hearing about it. But say, what are you struggling with? And, you know, what is your superpower in this transition? And what is your kryptonite? And let's make sure, because we tend to partner with people who have opposite skills than we do.
Trying to be self-aware around that, and strengths and weaknesses.
And other aware. So it's not just self-aware, it's also other aware.
You alluded to this at the beginning, you know, when you go through a wealth event, you know, with respect to that next generation, because it's a fear that a lot of our families have is I don't want to screw up my kids. Most of our families are first generation wealth and didn't grow up with money and hear the horror stories about trust fund kids and whatnot. You know, I know you mentioned when you spoke at our event that the values many times of our kids around money and values in general are different than ours. How do you recommend or what have you seen as some best practices for kind of bridging that gap and broaching the subject?
Just a couple of things off the top of my head. Number one, you know, as we talked about in at our event in outside of Seattle, I would say the first thing, let's talk about lifequakes. One of the things that my data has unveiled and one of the kind of interesting subtle things about it, this idea of nonlinearity, like Xers understand it more than boomers, millennials more than Xers, and you know, Gen Zers more even than millennials. Like, so there's this sort of transition gap, I call it sometimes, which is like sometimes boomer parents are looking at their 30-something kids and saying, wait, you're having a baby like before you get married? Like, or you're moving to a new city and you don't know what you're going to do? Or like you're leaving one job without knowing what you're going to do for the next job? Yes, that's actual. So they are more comfortable with this. And I say that because I think it's important to remember that the next generation's relationship with intergenerational wealth might be different than Gen 1. I mean, we know this as somebody who does a lot of events with high net worth families, that Gen 1, you know, meaning the generation that makes it, has a different set of relationships with the money than Gen 2 and Gen 3 even than Gen 2. So understand that that's natural, that is not your way of looking at this, which probably in many cases grows out of your own trauma, maybe of having no money. Like it's a different set of, I mean, trauma may be the worst word, but it's a different set of issues when you're growing up with wealth than you're not. And you shouldn't just assume that your values are the only values, or especially don't assume that they are the right values. Okay. So that would be, I would say, the first thing. And again, the way to do this is talk about it. And often in this case, I will say having an outsider in the room is very helpful because you sit up a little bit straighter, you're a little bit nicer, you know, and there is some value in having someone like you and your wonderful colleagues that I met at Parsion who just do this all day, every day and have some chops to you and some pattern recognition that the people in it might not have, and you can soften the emotions and you're going to have some techniques. And then the last thing I would say is a lot of your assumptions are wrong. The idea that intergenerational wealth by definition creates spoiled, lazy children is not accurate. There is no data. I've looked at this data inside and out over many years. I've talked to a lot and become friendly with a lot of people who do what you do. It is not necessarily true. Anybody can look at a multi-generational wealth family and see some kids who have work ethics and some kids who do not. It is not connected to the wealth in and of itself. It's connected to the values, and it's connected to the family, and it's connected to the individuals. And that's what you need to focus on. There is no magic quality in intergenerational wealth that creates laziness, nor is there a magic quality that creates, you know, resilience or diligence. That is separate from the money. It might exacerbate it on some occasions, but it does not in and of itself, it's not contagious in the negative way that many people fear.
So without getting into necessarily the particular values, what is the way to kind of help increase the odds of success there on that transition? Is it simply communication?
Well, that's a lot of it. I mean, I'm almost, there's what I call the 80% rule. 80% is communication, but 80% is also having the right advisors and 80%. I'm not convinced in my life that the 80-20 rule is wrong, that everything is 80%. So I don't think communication is 100%, but I do think it's 80%. But I think that the way, you know, again, without knowing the particulars of situation, the way I would say it is there are certain things that money can do that can reduce stress. Okay. And not create this sense of dependency that people fear. Let's talk about, you know, I think I used when I was with you this acronym HEALTH. You know, health is a great one. Okay. H, you know, I got cancer at 43. And my father, who ran a second generation business that now my brother and I run as a third generation business, and now we're having conversations about our next gen, you know, my father was like, you have to take time off. This is what money is for. So the idea of denying your children money if one of them gets, you know, a life threatening cancer at 43, that's ridiculous. And so just to hold to some position that you think you have, the money should only be your. health. Education is another example of an indirect use of, you know, travel is a good example. Okay. We're going to take some family trips. Okay. I mean, I just write you a check, but there are things you can do with your money to create intergenerational benefits that are far, far short of just a handout. I don't think there's not a lot of evidence that the handouts themselves work, particularly when people are in their 20s, you know, and beginning to sort of define who they are. But if someone's got a path and their life is set, real estate is another way. I know a lot of families that say, you know what, you make your own choices. Okay, and what you want to do, you expect to support yourself. I'm not just going to give you money, but when you're ready to buy a home, you know, you come and see me. So there are ways that you can do this. The thing that you don't want is to say you don't have to work, but there are challenges here. What if one person goes to law school, but one person chooses to become a school teacher? You know, that's a complicated situation that you're going to have to figure out within your family. But if you protect them and you tell the school teacher, if you get into a bind, you know, medically, or, you know, if you want to, if I can help you pay for college or whatever, I'm just holding it all that's yours and then dumping it on them when both of the first gen kind of passes and it becomes an inheritance issue. That's really equipping people poorly.
And that's really helpful. You mentioned something at our event. Keep going back to that. And if anybody listening to this wants to hear that talk, we did record it. It's really helpful. It was on kind of happy families, which is another one of your books. But you mentioned, you know, and it goes along with the nonlinear life that you've been talking about. And, you know, we all know entrepreneurs who had a big success, but it was preceded by maybe a failure. Right. And that fueled and taught. But we celebrate the wins. Right. We talk about the wins. We don't always talk about the harder parts and the struggles and the challenges. Can you talk about, because I'm not going to do it the same justice as you would. Can you talk about kind of the peaks and the valleys and why it's important to share those things with the next generation as well?
There is a connection between my work with Happy Families. I wrote a column in the New York Times, as you alluded to at the outset, for a decade on Happy Families. And I wrote a book called The Secrets of Happy Families, which encapsulates a lot of these ideas about how high-functioning families, what patterns and things they do most successfully. And the single most interesting idea that I encountered on that has to do with the value of knowing your family history. And it was that knowledge that in fact personally propelled me into this work of collecting and analyzing life stories and now collecting and analyzing work stories in this new book of mine, The Search. And the work came from two psychologists at Emory University, Marshall Duke and Robin Vivish. And what they found was that they created something that I termed in the New York Times, the do you know test. Do you know what happened when your grandparents were born? Do you know what happened? Do you have an aunt or an uncle who had an illness that they overcame? You know, do you know what happened when your parents met or around the time of your birth? And the children who scored highest on this test, which means the children who knew more about their family history, it was the number one predictor of a child's emotional well-being. And when I asked Marshall Duke, who's become a mentor and sort of guiding light in my life when my children started this college application death march, as I called it, I took them to see Marshall because I knew he would be wise. And what he told me is that families, there are three types of family narratives. There's an ascending family narrative. We started from nothing. We worked hard. We have a lot. There's a descending family narrative. We had a lot. There was a war or a recession, you know, or a pandemic, and we lost everything. Or there's what he called an oscillating family narrative, right? You know, your grandfather came here. He was he built a business and then his house burned down. His daughter was the first in the family to go to college, you know, and then she got breast cancer. And children who understand that life has a kind of natural oscillating rhythm. There are ups and there are downs. They know that when they hit a setback, a bump in the road, their own, you know, sine curve down or negative oscillation, that they know people in their lives who overcame it. And when I have talked about this, Terry, across the country, and when I do, people nod, oh yeah, I do that. Oh yeah, oh no, well, we definitely do that. No way. That is actually not what happened. You know that thing, I don't know that much about, how old are your kids?
From 24 down to 11, so.
Right, so you probably, maybe with 11-year-old, you had this experience with now we have all this Purell, whatever, these hand sanitizers, right? You're coming around my baby, you have to sanitize yourself. You have to go into a chamber, right? And like, and we now know you can actually over-sanitize yourself and not, you know, let your newborn be accustomed to some germs. That's what we do to our children. We don't tell them about the setbacks. We don't tell them about the tough years in the business. You know, we want to be like, you know, pound our chest. I'm pounding my chest here. Like, I just sold this business, right? I'm going to send your grandkids to college. Well, you're harming them by not showing them that you had struggles. You do this in an age-appropriate way. What you tell an 11-year-old is different from what you tell a 24-year-old. But the point is you want to be open about this so that when your kids get these setbacks, they understand it. And so it is really important. You know, I like to say this to grandparents, right? When you come over, don't criticize your parents, your child's, or even worse, your child's spouse's parenting. Take the grandkids, tell the parents, go give them a night out and talk to the, you know, take them to the, one of my things is like, take them to the cemetery, like show them the relatives, like show them the difficult things, like normalize talking about painful moments as well as joyful moments. It is surprisingly powerful and empowering to the next generations.
I love that. Thank you for that. So much of your work applies to everybody, but particularly some of the work that we do with the families that we serve. Two final questions, and they're fun ones. If you could give your younger self a piece of advice as you began your professional career, what is one thing that you would want to share with your younger self?
Run into the fire. What I mean by that is there's a wonderful book called Young Men in Fire by Norman MacLean about the fire hunters in the American West. This is something that's maybe more instinctual to you. I grew up in the American South, so right, so we have hurricanes. We don't have wildfires like you guys have on the West Coast, and maybe you have them less in the Northwest because it's, you know, naturally wetter. But anyway, so these fire jumpers would go in, and sometimes the flames would get out of control and they would come to them. And they found that people who tried to outrun the fire never outran the fire. They would be caught by it. That the way to solve the problem when the fire was raging toward you was to take a small area, burn it, and then go sit in, and then the fire will jump over you. So this, I think, is one of the great metaphors of life. Like, so when the emotions are coming, you know, when the stuff is hitting the fan, when it's difficult, when your business is failing and you're in the bottom of the oscillation, don't run away from it, run toward it. Talk about the emotions, you know, engage with those around you, run toward the fire.
And as a final question, and again, it's a fun one for me, you know, we at Parsion never lose sight of what we're here to do for the families we support. And with wealth management, the long-term goal is to simply support their goals and dreams. One of the most common goals after a sale, I would say top three for just about every family, is to travel more or to travel better. So fun question leads me to the closing question, which is one we ask all the families that we serve because we want to support their goals. But describe to me your dream vacation. I know you mentioned that you're getting ready to take a family vacation, but what would be your dream vacation?
I don't know if I'm the perfect person to ask for this or the worst person to ask for this because I've been to 90 countries in my life. And for decades, I was a professional travel writer. And I actually was at a dinner last night and I'm coming up on my 20th anniversary. And so we're planning out some trips with our kids. And we had some dinner with a couple last night that also is planning a trip. This was in Brooklyn. They were talking about going to Morocco because it was both, you know, adventurous, but also romantic, you know, it had some shopping and it had some leisure. And I think that and I mentioned earlier the, you know, going to the art museum with one of my daughters yesterday. So I think that my answer to this question is really ties back in a nice way to what we've been talking about families and wealth, to realize that everybody wants something different out of this vacation. Somebody wants to sit by the pool for a while. Somebody wants to go shopping. Somebody wants to, you know, go to the museum. And somebody wants to have an adventure where they ride they ski down the Black Diamond or they ride in a balloon. And to realize that one person shouldn't be telling everybody else what to do. That an ideal vacation, whether it's Morocco where I was recently, whether it's France where we're taking our family, or Bali where I'm going to head this summer accompanying my wife on a work trip, is that everybody should get part of it to control. Everybody should get part of what gives them meaning, and everybody should be willing to do something that gives others meaning, even if it wouldn't be at the top of their list. So get the thing you want, but also get out of your comfort zone and do what makes others happy.
Definitely a tip for a happy family on a family vacation. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for your time and sharing excerpts and lessons learned from your books. When is The Search coming out?
So Life is in the Transitions is available now. There is a TED Talk, as you mentioned, that's about to hit 2 million views. And I also now teach a TED course called How to Master Life Transitions. And my new book, which is called The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a Post-Career World, goes on sale on May 30th, 2023. And so I'm happy to share it with all of you. And I look forward to continuing the conversation with you or anybody listening in any way that can be helpful.
Really appreciate it. And to keep up with new episodes of What's Next, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google. You can also stream the episodes directly from our website at parcionpw.com. Again, that's parcionpw.com. Once again, Bruce, thanks for the time, and we will see everybody next time.
Parcion Private Wealth LLC is registered with the SEC as an investment advisor. All opinions expressed in today's episode are Terry's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed on this podcast should be considered investment, legal, tax, financial, or other advice. This show is solely for entertainment and informational purposes only. All topics addressed are of a general nature and do not address the circumstances of any particular individual.